Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our Patreon supporters, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. Thank you to patrons including Tony Miles, Jack, who joined us this week. Welcome, Jack. John M., Brian Jones, Neil Fisher, Paul Davison, Mark McAvoy, John Evans, loads more, all of whom we love dearly and are supporting us in the best way possible. From fan to us. Teachers in Hull were given detention this week after a bit of well-intentioned but ill-advised coursework resulted in angry parents asking why their children were being asked to research hardcore pornography and genital mutilation on Google. The Hull Daily Mail reported that teachers had asked 11 to 14-year-olds to define pornography, including soft pornography, hardcore pornography, transsexual pornography, as well as female genital mutilation, trafficking, male circumcision, breast ironing, and more. One parent of an 11-year-old girl said her daughter was asking her about these topics because she was doing her lessons from home on the computer. The newspaper quoted her mother as saying they'd been told to use Google and she would have had to search all these things. She did a Google hardcore porn. She Googled hardcore porn and some of the images that came up were disturbing, she said. The school in question has apologised after numerous parents complained. Now, this to me seems like the kind of thing that probably someone should have thought about in a bit more detail than asking 11-year-olds who are working at their own computers at home to start Googling pornography. But my question for you, Ian, is would this topic have played out any differently if this had been done in school? Or is this, do you think this is worse because it was being done on home computers where perhaps kids were left on their own without supervision and potentially there was no one who was stepping in? I can't imagine parents are sitting and spending all 8 hours of a day behind their children while they study.
Well, no, because it's not possible, is it? I mean, you know, like, this is the big struggle for parents at the moment. And, you know, I'm aware that a lot of people choose not to have children and, you know, don't probably care about the issues. But yeah, you know, it's amazing how much, you need to, even just doing normal schoolwork is challenging enough. And it's interesting how quickly children learn how to use things. So, you know, like, put them on an iPad and before long they've worked everything out, and so therefore at that point they're no longer safe to be left alone with these things without either parental controls being put in place or constant monitoring. And my kids work on the iPads, so that the school sets things through a couple of different sites, the biggest one being Seesaw, and they have iPad apps, so they can send their work through the iPad, which is really good. It works quite well, actually. It lets them either do the, you know, use it something like their finger to draw, or an Apple Pencil, or, you know, whatever you might have on Android works on both. But yeah, it's good. But they have to be on those devices to do it. And Izzy will just get on with her schoolwork and she's fine. But I'm not monitoring that. Fortunately, I think my kids' school would not ask questions like this. It seems quite ridiculous for an 11-year-old to be told to define those topics. I mean,
I want to be clear that obviously, because this is a tech topic, I don't have much to say about whether 11-year-olds should be studying pornography or not, although I kind of feel they probably shouldn't. It's really, I suppose, just about the nature of how this research would necessarily need to be done. Because as Charlotte and John rightly point out in our live chat, if this had been done at school, because of the strict nature of educational filters that school networks have, any of these searches would have almost certainly blocked everything that could have been at least an immediate shock or risk, whereas at home that's not necessarily in any way the case. And if it's a family computer that everyone uses, or a family iPad or something, it may well be that you know, mummy and daddy don't want the porn to be blocked, but they're also not expecting their 11-year-old daughter to be Googling genital mutilation and transsexual pornography, which are worthy being studied, but just perhaps not and not out of the confines of a restricted network environment.
Yeah, and I think even if your network was restricted enough, I think it's a difficult topic to do without guidance. I think there's some value to be said for explaining to children a bit about the world. I do think 11 is a bit young. I mean, yeah, maybe 13, 14 is a bit more appropriate. But, you know, I think there is a difference between teaching children about, you know, staying safe online and being responsible and the normal, you know, health and safety stuff that we probably did to some extent as children. I don't remember it being brilliant. But these sort of things invite problems in this particular example. You can't give someone Google and tell them to search, anything to do with pornography, because it will return pornography. And that's not neither the intention of the teaching nor ideal for children.
Mm. This is part of the curriculum, and I did mean to mention this, but thanks to Charlotte who pointed this out, that it is part of the PSHE, which is personal, social, health, and
yes,
economic personal, education,
so, health. No, health, personal, social, and health education.
Is it okay? I thought it was economic. Yeah. It is part of the curriculum, and. It's not my place to argue about what's right and wrong in schools, because I don't have kids. But I do think that if this had been done in school, it would have been a lot safer than asking people to Google it at home.
Yeah, definitely. I just don't think that that's a. I think this is a good example of what a textbook is for. You know, it rather than, you know, and I know we're a tech podcast, but you know, if you hand kids a textbook that has definitions of these, then you can control what the definition is, and you can make it so that it's, you know, like to explain the issues without giving them too much information or not enough kind of thing. Whereas the internet is very bad for that kind of thing. Could you use Wikipedia for all these searches, and then you'd probably be at least protected from imagery, but you would still probably have graphic language that wouldn't be ideal.
Yeah, I mean, I have noticed on Wikipedia that there are many medical and biological entries that do include explicit depictions of things, but they're not shocking because they're clearly there for purpose. You know, they're just to illustrate a thing. They're not presented in this realm in a sexualized way. They're being presented as, you know, here is a set of genitals. This is how they work. This is
and
what
kids
happens.
Have genitals, so they're not surprised by their their existence. And yeah, I mean, they'll find it funny, obviously, because a photo of your someone else's genitals is inherently funny to them.
Yeah,
so
I get that. John is a teacher, so he's a teacher in real life, but he's in the live chat and is also a teacher. He said a good idea is to create a web quest where the teacher creates pre-directed links that kids go to rather than just going to Google and searching, basically a form full of URLs that they can click, and then from there use that as a starting point for their research rather than just going to Google and typing in hardcore porn, which is perhaps unsurprisingly to those of us with knowledge of how the internet works, only ever going to end in questions over suitability. But any thoughts anyone has on this, obviously do let us know. hello@uktechshow.com. Gizmodo wrote that the BBC is once again dropping hints that BBC Three could earn itself a proper slot back on the terrestrial and satellite EPGs of the world, because the channel's run with commissioning hits basically has made it seem a little more viable than it was several years ago. The potential comeback was revealed within the BBC's annual plan, which was published this week, and the Beeb wrote, quote, BBC Three has been a hit machine. Such is its performance, we will consider the merit of restoring it as a linear channel. While young people would continue to predominantly watch BBC Three content online, we believe that with the depth of content we now have available, there are still more people we could reach through a linear channel. Now, it's worth recapping a little bit the history of BBC Three's relationship with the streaming world. It was originally, I think as far back as 2003, a terrestrial broadcast channel. So just like BBC One's and Two, you know, BBC's yeah. One and Two. Things like Gavin and Stacey came out of it. Fleabag, I think. Torchwood. This Country, which I've recently been watching and is absolutely brilliant. But BBC Director General Tony Hall announced about 5 or 6 years ago that the channel was going to be moved to the iPlayer only, and as part of that, have its budget slashed by more than a third, I think from about 85 million to 25 million. They were part of what it thought were necessary cost-cutting moves, but people got very angry. But the reasoning was basically that this is a channel for the youth, for the young, and they want to watch stuff online, not on telly. So why not shove it all online and save some money in the process? So that's what they did. But then the popularity of its actual commissions was such that the BBC thinks that now actually maybe it belongs back on mainstream broadcast schedules, presumably in addition, obviously, to everything being available online. Now, the risk here is that the BBC still needs to cut costs, huge numbers of costs, in fact. And if BBC Three is to get more investment and more terrestrial attention, then something else is going to get less. And rumours are that that may be BBC Four, the home of factual stuff and documentaries, that's staring rather witheringly up at the sharp end of an axe wielded by a masked commissioning editor. So,
yeah, do you want some help? Shall I just step in at this point?
I would love some help, please.
Well, yeah, you're right in what you say about BBC Three. It was obviously it was originally BBC Choice, I believe. It was one of the launch channels for, well, in that form, for when the BBC started digital terrestrial back in the late 90s, I want to say. What was it, 98? I can't even remember
anymore. When BBC Choice came about.
Yeah, when we started having digital TV instead of just analog.
If you don't know, I certainly don't.
Yeah,
off the top of my head.
I think I want to say it was around 98, 99. Is that too late? Yeah, no, it's not. So that was a thing. And obviously it had struggled recently because young audiences, first of all, don't particularly gravitate towards the BBC, you know, and also there's Netflix and things like that. And so it was having an impact. And with online streaming, the BBC already has a very capable platform in iPlayer, and it seemed to make a lot of sense to save the money from traditional broadcast, which is very, very expensive, and move it online, which is probably not that expensive in comparison. But moving it back onto TV strikes me as a very weird decision. I think the audience for BBC Three is always going to be much more savvy. They don't consider things to be of a channel. That, you know, it's like, I watched this streaming thing, or I saw it on YouTube or whatever. And I think that's perfectly reasonable for young people. So having a branded channel just doesn't seem like a smart use of money to me, and I would certainly be very reluctant to remove BBC Four, which is something that probably wouldn't work quite as well streamed only. Like, it's good that it's on iPlayer, but I just feel like having it as a channel makes more sense because it's aimed at older people. It's probably a much more traditional viewing model than anything else. So cutting that and putting that on online only would be silly. I never understood why they had to get rid of BBC Three from broadcast anyway.
Were watching it online. A huge percentage of people were watching it online rather than on terrestrial.
Yes,
in terms of
but
demographics and how it was splitting between the two.
That would be perfectly acceptable in a commercial environment. But the BBC is a public service broadcaster, and therefore it has to, and does a really good job for the most part, in considering that, you know, some people may not have broadband at all, or they may not have broadband good enough to do proper streaming. And people in lower income families will probably have a TV and therefore they've got all the equipment they need in order to watch BBC Three, whereas, you know, a laptop or a smart TV or something like that would be maybe too much money. So therefore, having a terrestrial channel digital makes a lot of sense, because it means that everyone can get access to it. And, you know, and there's a lot to be said. We've just had a conversation about kids on the internet. You know, if you're a parent and you want, you know, you think the kids would enjoy something on BBC Three, then you've got to give them a device that's capable of going online, and then, you know, you lose control of that, don't you? So therefore, there is something to be said for, we know that TV is a safe thing for most people. Therefore, it's an easy win. So there's a lot of stuff here. I personally think that it should be allowed to carry on, and I don't see why you'd go to the effort of putting it back, given that it's not currently there.
I mean, I think what BBC Three has done very well with is creating an identity for itself, because I can spot a BBC Three commission a mile off, you know, but from a thumbnail alone, I would guess I could correctly identify a BBC Three original faster than I could identify an original from any other BBC property, you know, and not just because the thumbnails feature young people or people who dress like they are people that I would never hang out with because we have nothing in common, but just some of the show titles and the way that the people in the pictures have been presented, or the descriptions, like you can just tell. And I think they've done an excellent job of creating that identity. I just don't know if that's an identity that can withstand being moved into the prime time, for the same reason it didn't in the first place when it was shifted online. It's very strange to me. I mean, I suppose the equivalent, I'm trying to think of what the equivalent would be for, say, for our US listeners, and it would be something like MTV coming out with all of its, you know, very young oriented reality stuff and saying, well, everyone's watching this online, so we'll pull MTV off cable and put it online, and then everyone goes online and says, well, this Kardashian thing or whoever broadcasts that seems to be really, really popular, so let's bung it back, and instead we'll get rid of I don't know, some documentary
my feeling is that there's, you know, and I've always sort of felt this way. Back in the day, do you remember when Lost arrived on American TV years ago?
I do.
Well, so at the time, and I remember this quite clearly, the first episode, the pilot, leaked. It was one of the most expensive, I think it probably was at the time, definitely the most expensive pilot for TV ever shot. It was incredibly ambitious. And it leaked online, and there was a lot of hand-wringing by the thing. But what it did was a lot of people saw it and were like, this is amazing, I'm going to absolutely watch this show, which probably drove people back to TV to see it. I think the point is that what having BBC Three online allowed them to do was experiment a bit more, because it was cheaper. They were able to find, through experience, program formats that worked and picked up traction and were considered very good. And that gave them a sort of an easy way to audition things. Moving it back onto TV then immediately means it's much, much more expensive. It's not more expensive to shoot, because it's the same process, but it means that you've got to go through all this rigmarole of putting it on a channel. So therefore, perhaps the solution to this is that you continue to do the online bit for the majority of it, and then you put the most popular stuff on a channel, and that gives you kind of, and then maybe that channel will become so popular that it expands further. But there is only a finite amount of money in the BBC's budget, and I can see why difficult decisions have to be made, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to bring back BBC Three, which is already doing well online, at the cost of BBC Four, which we don't know if that would do well online. So I would say it's probably better not to do this than to do it.
Well, anyone who has views on this, of course, send them to the usual place, hello@uktechshow.com. One thing I just wanted to mention is there's some praise going on for the show This Country in the Discord, a BBC Three original. And having just watched all three series of it, I discovered that there is a three-hour audiobook on Amazon, on Audible, that is all brand new content, written and presented by the cast, and is well worth the Audible credit order to go and listen to.
Can you give me an elevator pitch for this thing, so that I
for
know
this,
or
for
not
this
I,
country
I want to watch it? Yeah,
think of if the office was about a little village in the Cotswolds rather than a little office in Slough.
Okay. I can see your point there. That seems reasonably interesting.
Know, it's farmers instead of paper retailers, and it's Vickers instead of David Brent. Well,
fair
no,
enough.
He's not the David Brent equivalent. But it's that vein. It's a docu. It's a docudrama. It's a mockumentary. And it reminds me of a lot of my childhood, even though I didn't grow up in the Cotswolds.
Fair enough.
Well worth a listen.
Did I demand that you watch Future Man on Amazon yet?
Future Man.
Exactly.
No.
That's it. That sums it up. It's the first season is very, very good. The second season and the third season have a lull in the middle, but overall, it was a very good show. Oh. I do commend it.
I'm still in love with Stathlet's Flats. We've just watched those. It's probably my favourite TV discovery of the year, and I would probably include last year's TV discoveries.
What's it called?
In there, it's called Stathlet's Flats. STATH, Let's Flats. It's on Channel 4. And it sits somewhere between Alan Partridge, Borat, and a little bit The Office as well. It's not a mockumentary, but
that name is actually breaking my brain.
Yeah, Stathlet's Flats. I absolutely adore it. It's probably one of the funniest shows I've discovered in the last couple of years.
Can't keep leaving messages, man. The last tenants left it like a filth out here. There's an oven that's covered in a ladder. Al just picked up a brick and there was some salad underneath it.
Oh, it's fine.
What? Have you seen how much crock there is on the floor? Putting more crock on it.
Man, I'm tired. You left me lonely with these sticks. I haven't even had an egg for energy or nothing.
Ian, I wanted to spend the last part of this show talking about something that you're doing that forced us to record this podcast early today. You said that you are going to do a 24-hour gaming live stream.
Yeah.
For a reason you didn't actually explain, but you did say that it's going to be between Destiny 2 and Unreal Tournament, the latter of which I adore. So can you tell us a little bit about this? Take us back to the beginning. Why are you streaming gaming for 24 hours?
Well, so originally the idea was, and Marta is a part of this, and she's in our chat at the moment. They've done a number of charity streams for 24 hours. So they sit down, they do a stream, 24 hours, hope to raise some money. We wanted to do the same thing again, but everyone's been so busy that that's sort of kind of fallen by the wayside. So not sure how we're going to approach that. I'm going to donate some money to a charity anyway, but I wanted to experience what it was like to do something for 24 hours without a break, and then see whether or not that broke my brain. If anyone wants to donate to charities, I'm very happy to post some of the ones that we will probably be involved with in some way, and we'll see how it goes. It's very difficult with streaming and stuff like that. I haven't twitched very much in my life, but I'm going to give it a go, and we'll see whether or not anyone watches it, because that's the big problem. For someone without an audience that pre-exists, you know, it's difficult to know whether or not you'd actually get any traction on it. But I'm curious. Marta's done it twice before, and had good success with it. But the comedy of staying up for 24 hours playing a few games is undeniable, I'm sure. 24 hours is a long time to be awake, trying to focus on gaming. And yes, Destiny 2 is going to be a big part of it. We're going to do all the raids. So that's, Marta reckons that's probably 12 hours. And then we're going to go on to do sillier things once we're done. Have you ever heard of Prop Hunt?
No.
It's part of, it's Gary's mod, which is...
Before we get to the weeds about that, I just wanted to take a step back a little bit. How are you preparing then to do 24 hours of live streaming? Are you going to have like a, let's call it a comfort bottle? Or a bowl?
You don't have to be on the stream all the time. I mean, you know, like the idea is it's 24 hours of gaming. Going to the bathroom is perfectly acceptable and will happen on a regular basis. I will need to go to the shop and track down some snacks and things to sustain me for such an extended period. There will need to be walking around at some point. We don't want anyone getting deep vein thrombosis. So it's going to be interesting. But
if you are being sponsored, then of course I will. I wouldn't. I think you should still carry on gaming if you go for a poo or go to the shops. Otherwise, it's not 24 hours.
I won't be going to the shops within the period of the stream. The only things that will be happening in that period that aren't gaming related will be going to get a snack, filling up my water, having a coffee, ruining my body with diet soda. So it will be more than likely 24 hours. What you've got to bear in mind with like the Destiny raid portion of this anyway is that the raids move relatively slowly. There is always a break when you wipe, you know, you everyone dies or whatever.
Oh, right. Sorry. You know, it's a very different mental image there, but yes.
So there will be an element of you know, natural break in the stream. If you watch a Twitch streamer who's on for sort of between 4 and 8 hours, there's almost nothing happens for 90% of it. Like you're in menus and all that kind of stuff. So there'll be an aspect of that. We'll see how it goes. And then hopefully this is kind of like a baby version. And if it goes well, then I imagine that everyone involved will probably do the Stand Up To Cancer drive again in October. And we'll see. But this will either make it or break it for me. Because, you know, we're lucky. It's a bank holiday weekend. We're doing 8 p.m. Sunday tonight to 8 p.m. Monday, bank holiday Monday. So if it turns out that I can't do it, I will be able to do it. But if I, after it's finished, I can just go straight to bed and the week will continue probably largely as if nothing happened. And I've got some holiday as well. So I'm not going to be jeopardizing my work life for 12 hours of Destiny and some prop hunt. I didn't explain what prop hunt is. It's basically hide and seek. But the team that's hiding can disguise themselves as in-world items. So, you know, that might be a discarded can of drink, and then people have to go around and shoot things to try and work out who's hiding where. It's hilarious.
I said to Marta if she wanted to unmute herself and come and talk about what it's like having done one of these 24-hour streams in the past, we'd be very interested.
Hello.
So you've done one of these 24-hour you've done several of these 24-hour streams before. What's the hardest part of doing a 24-hour gaming stream?
By far the hardest part is actually the time between 5 a.m. and 8 a.m. It's the worst. It's because you've already gone all night. And that's when your body starts trying to tell you, stop. Enough, you know, and you're still trying to just get through the slog of it, and hopefully, like, and that's usually when we switch to something simpler, because nobody has, like, something like prop hunt, because nobody has any mind capacity left to figure out Destiny 2's raid mechanics. But we've tried, so we've experimented with time, right? Because the first one we did was, I think, 9 p.m. or 10 p.m. until 10 p.m. the next day. And then the second one was we started 10 a.m. and then finished at 10 a.m. the next day. And we found that the next worst part was if you finish at 10 a.m., you still have to stay awake for the rest of the day or you genuinely get jet lag. It's an experience.
It makes sense, doesn't it, if you think about it? Because the way we're doing it now, it will finish at 8 tomorrow. Anyone who's completely ruined can just pretty much go straight to bed. So it's not the end of the world. And you know, a good night's sleep should make up for the 24 hours of, or the, you know, the 12 hours previously of missed sleep. That's that. Nick's asking in the chat whether whether it's one game or we'll always switch. Yeah, we do switch. For exactly the reason you just said.
Yeah. So it's the first 12 hours or so, we're going to try to finish every single Destiny 2 raid, which is a six-person endeavor where you have multiple levels. And it's not just, here's a bunch of, you know, enemies, shoot them all. It has very complicated area puzzles and mechanics, and each individual player has a role to play. You have to be really organized and communicate well, which is where the hilarity happens as you get more time to repeatedly, as we in the gaming world say, wipe. So that's the first one. And then to sort of palate cleanse, if you will, we go do sillier things like prop hunt. And I'm still looking for that clip of me running around as a PC being shot at and screwing PC Master Race and Serpentine. It's that kind of weirdness. We're also going to be playing Murderous Pursuits, which is a really cool little game by a UK studio, indie studio.
I don't have that yet. I need to buy it, don't I? And download it.
It's a really, really cool kind of, again, whodunit, hide and seek, steampunky thing. And yeah, it's just great fun as a multiplayer game. But this one's the first one that we're also going to have Americans on our stream.
It's funny that you didn't use an American accent to
I know
to announce that. You sort of went
Americans.
Yeah, sort of a bit Eastern European, South Russian, which you do very well, of course, being Slovenian. But interesting. Yeah.
It's gonna be something that you can very easily, you know, tune into, have like laugh along with us or at us, your choice, and then exit and come back to it later. One thing I wanted to highlight around prop hunt is it'd be so difficult to try to find anybody because you're basically using the Counter-Strike source engine, I guess, to have all this. And you can basically turn yourself into any object that has physics attributed to it. And you can blend so well that if the hunters were able to just shoot anything at will, that you just go, you know, mow the lawn, so to speak, until you find everybody. But you actually take damage if you shoot something that isn't a player. So you have to be careful. And then you have sound clips that you can play as taunts, that the closer you are, the louder it gets. That can be anything. And it's a lot of clips from different shows and movies. And we, this time, for the first time ever, we've created our own taunt pack.
It's basically things, dumb stuff that one of us has said from mostly from the Destiny raids, actually, where we're, you know, someone's exclaimed something or said something inappropriate by accident. So those are the taunts we're using. So it should be quite entertaining to watch, I think. But
well, we'll include a link in the MP3 description, in the Discord, on the Patreon page, in the show notes at uktechshow.com for anyone who wants to stream this live, and we'll link to whatever we can. I'm sure Ian and Marta will send over some links that we can include on the blog at uktechshow.com to see some of these older things. Marta, thank you ever so much for coming on and joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
Well, text message keeps you informed about the British tech landscape, of course, but let's check in with Tom Merritt, Daily Tech News Show, and find out what's been happening in the wider daily world of technology over the last week.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, Aunt Pruitt helped us understand mirrorless cameras in advance of the Canon R5. We covered all the cool announcements from supercomputers to Windows Power Tools out of Microsoft Build, why the new U.S. trade rules targeted at Huawei might not affect Huawei at all, and we discussed why Netflix is canceling subscriptions from inactive accounts, as well as celebrating the AI achievement of a generative adversarial network that can create Pac-Man from scratch. Happy birthday, Pac-Man. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Yeah, well, that sounds great.
Yeah, the Pac-Man is great because it reminded me that its original name was Puck-Man, but they had to change it for Western ears to avoid any risk of it being mispronounced. But do check DTNS. I particularly enjoyed this week, actually, the explanation of how mirrorless cameras work. It's something I use all the time, but hearing a nice, concise, technical explanation of how they compare to old-style DSLR cameras, it's well worth checking out. So that's at dailytechnewsshow.com. Thank you, Tom. I also wanted to promote an extra message that I did earlier this week, because we didn't talk on the show about Spotify getting an exclusive deal with the podcaster Joe Rogan, because it didn't really feel very UK tech newsy, but it's very inside baseball for me as a podcaster of many years to talk about. So that's out at patreon.com/UK tech for all of the patrons that get extra message, because I used it as a way of exploring the last 15 years of my slight annoyances with big broadcasters and radio stations, and now platforms using podcasts as collateral damage in their expansion plans. But I've since decided that actually Spotify getting exclusive podcasts is probably good for podcasting overall and for the little guy. So that's a 20-minute extra show that's out as extra message at patreon.com/UK tech. Hope some of you may check that out. Ian, it's been a great pleasure of mine, and I do believe I speak on behalf of everyone listening that it's been moderately interesting for them as well.
It's been great. It's been wonderful. And I think we've achieved our goal of having a slightly less serious show this week that was, a little bit of light relief, shall we say.
I've been so jaded by every single conversation being about COVID-19, and we could have talked about the COVID-19 contact tracing apps, but to be honest, I just sort of feel like we need a bit of a break. We need to talk about live streaming games. We need to talk about schools getting kids to Google things that were ill-advised, and things that are a little bit more fun and cathartic to discuss than the depressing nature of a pandemic. So I hope that's been okay with everybody, and we'll continue to do this as ever next weekend, which is when we'll see you next. Take care, everybody.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.